1914. It was Mr. Irwin Jolly by Cranston Wilcox and Hale Pierce on Thursday, January 29, 1981. Mr. Jolly was an employee of the Coldwater Cement Factory, working as a dredge operator excavating Morrow, and also as a barge operator moving Morrow to the factory, and in winter mapping depths of Morrow deposits in the chain of lakes for later excavation.
Good morning.
What was the name of the company?
Wolverine Portland.
Was it going when you started?
Oh, yeah. It had been going. Another company, I'm not sure, but around the turn of the century, as near as I can get it, was when that place started. And in that area. But it was, we moved here in 1918. And we had, my dad and I went into trucking business here. And Lucas's were in at the same time. So we worked back and forth. Did they get a job that was heavy or needed some help with? Why, we'd put in a truck or two and help, you know, work together. And but we used to, about that time, the cement company bought these old quad duplexes right in that area in the 23-4. And it was army surplus, but they're four-wheel drive, hard-tired trucks. And they got it in their hands.
Duplex.
Sure. And they were four-wheel drive, and they were quite a thing in the World War, you know.
Yeah.
Well, they got them, but they were pretty well shot. So a lot of times, they wouldn't be able to get them started, and they'd call us, and we'd put a canvas over our state truck and come into town and pick up men and take them off work, see, for the change of shifts. And that was where I got started getting acquainted. And then a whole lot...
Wait a minute.
Was the one that, I don't know just when he started in there, but it was before that time, because he was the general manager. And Louis Nodell, that was his first year, because I was one of the first guys that Louis hired. And I'll never forget, because before that I'd worked at Pratt's and got the, where I thought I had a pretty good job there, running Schaefer. That's one of these two-headed things, you know, that you work inside with. Travel better than 5,000. And so I was in the deal here with Louis, and I tried to find out if they paid overtime. And he said they're never going to have any. Well, it just happened that we had more overtime than we did regular time, because there was, I would say if you got home at 11, 12 o'clock at night, you were lucky, because they wouldn't get the mud dug so that they could, tomorrow, so you could get it into them, you know. So there was a lot of time. We worked overtime. But that was the first year that Nodell came in there.
What was his position?
He was a plant superintendent. And, Murray was general manager. And I'm sure that's the way it was. Anyway, he had charge over the men, and of course, Frank was over the whole work. He was topped out above that, yes. And it wasn't only about 2 years, a year or so, anyway, that John Dalshaw, remember John Dalshaw? He got a boy or two, I believe, around somewhere in the area now. I can't think of. But anyway, John then took over Louis Nodell's job so that he was plant superintendent. But they didn't change a great deal up in the office too much.
When was Mike Seeley?
Mike was over the laboratory.
Your
chemist.
How many chemists did he
have? Oh, they must have had... I'd say probably three would be about the limit, one on each shift. And then they'd have sample boys that would go out through the mill and take samples off the kilns and off the mud what they call the slurry end of it, where they mix the marl and the clay and that stuff all together, and they take samples off of that to see what they... And when you took a load of marl into the mill, well, they would take samples of that so that they kept right on you all the time to see what the content of the sand was in that marl, see how strong the marl was, how much lime it had content in it. And then a lot of times in the wintertime, if they'd have some new bed that they wanted to, new lake that they wanted to go over, we'd take sampling rods and go out over this lake through the ice, and usually you'd have three or four 12-inch snuff boxes, and they were numbered, and they would put on that, draw a map, and then on these boxes, they'd take the number off that box and put it on their map, and you could come back within a foot length and sample that again if you wanted to, see, because you had the map there and everything to go by.
When you started, how much larger are the lakes now than they were when you started? Did you make the lake larger?
Oh, yes, a lot larger.
The Messenger Lake on the old map looks like just a little pond.
It was just a wide river.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, Messenger, of course, wasn't. That was a spring bed lake, Messenger.
On the right map, it's called Spring Lake.
That's right. That's right.
That's all made, wasn't it,
yeah,
by your
mostly. And then when I started out there, I wheeled tugs.
What do you mean by that?
To run the tugs. And they were, then they had switched over to kerosene. That Regal engines. Remember the old Regal up here?
Yeah.
Well, they put Regal's engines in those tugs. And I think the year before I was there, that I went out there, was when they pulled the last steamer, the last boiler out of it, out of the tugs, and put in the kerosene.
How many tugs did they
have? Oh, usually three and four.
You each pulled a barge or two, is that right?
Yes, one or two, and I have pulled three and even four already. After you get it started, why, it's no particular job, you know, you get that steady pressure on there, just like propeller driven.
So would they anchor the barges and
no.
fill them, or would you wait till they fill the barge?
They'd tie them up there at the dredge. If we run back to pick one up, they push it out by hand and slide another one into its place. See, they kept a whole lot of time, four or five scholars there to keep them going. Once in a while, but not often, that they'd let one go if the weather wasn't bad or something. Because when that scull was loaded, it would draw at least 6 foot of water.
How did they fill them? Did they have a
pump.
Oh, pump.
A pump.
Uh-huh. They pumped that marl out of the bottom. Did they have to stir it up?
No. You dug it out of the bottom with a dredge.
With a dredge.
And then you put it over in the other boat, and that went down through a big hopper. In fact, there were two hoppers there, and just for the world, like a sausage grinder. All right, you imagine one of them sausage grinders, where they
a worm dealing.
Yeah, that's right. And that would push it up against the head, and with those, oh, they're buried, but half 5/8-inch holes in the head of the plug mill, and that would push that through, and they had to just like a sausage grinder, a knife. They keep cutting the weeds and anything that would come up there, let it cut her loose, see, and the pressure from this screw, you did like a sausage grinder, would push them off, see. That would drop down in the bottom in a hopper here, a tapered hopper with a screw-driven auger in the bottom of it. There's the name for it. But anyway, that would pull the mud up to the other end of the boat, or the what we call the back end of the boat, where the scows were. And after it got it up there, then there was a steam-driven pump that forced it up into the spout and out of a 6-7-inch. It was all a 7-inch that went over into the hopper, see, the skull.
What was the load on the barge? Was it yards, cubic yards?
Most of the time, between 95 and 100.
Yards.
100 yards.
That's a pretty good size.
That's quite a lot. 60 feet long. And your hopper then was from the inside. You had an inside hopper that could held the marl. And then there were 6x6 timbers that give you an airspace on the side of the hopper and the outside of the skull, see. And usually that was 3-inch plank on the outside of your skull.
When you got back to cement plant, how did they unload it there?
Like suction again. This was suction. And it was a vacuum deal that putting steam in, and it was a two-cylinder job, not two-cylinder, but two tanks. They put steam in there, and in the process of this steam going in, I could get mixed up, but anyway, there was a cold air would wash it out, and then the steam would go in, and that formed a vacuum and would suck it up.
Hmm. Put the air out.
Yeah.
Vacuum.
Yeah.
Vacuum.
The change of hot to cold would cause a vacuum, see. And they had big flip valves on it that when they would open up, you know, and go up through. And
so did they have a storage then over at the cement factory?
Yeah, tanks.
Their tanks.
Mm-hmm.
You worked as long as you could until the ice formed, is that right?
And sometimes and more. Now we have 1 year, and I can't remember, 38, 37, somewhere in there. We worked 1 year up to the 5th or 6th of January because they needed the mud and the cement. And so we kept plugging, and we run channels about every hour at night when the company wasn't digging. But the most of the time, one man, you'd have a light crew on the dredge, on the boat. And one guy with a tug would go down and make that channel about every hour to keep it from freezing up.
There's a couple of instances I've heard discussed. Did you ever slow up down here at the road and let kids get out of this one? How far did you take them?
I'll take them through. They were cleared to the dredge and back. I got a bunch of them around here that are still going.
Right.
Max was one of them.
Bob Smith sent them up and they lose his life. In fact,
yeah. But I never lost one. But they did. I'd slow down. They'd drop on, you
drop
know.
On the,
at the old bridge. And, yeah.
The other thing that Stanford was telling me about is you did a little fishing while you were doing
that. Yeah. He usually carried when I first got out there in the spring of the year, I started in March, and I see the possibilities of it. So I went and had me a spear made, and I've got it out here yet. And I took coal roll steel, because I played around with blacksmith, and I was really raised with it, because back in them days, if you were born on a farm, you knew something about blacksmithing, you know, just natural. But I take a piece of coal roll steel, and I made me a turtle spear. But it wouldn't hold up just the way we wanted it, so I went out and finally found a piece of black diamond up here at Kerr's. All he had, I don't think he's over 18 inches of it, was that. Back then, I gave a pretty good price for that thing. And it was hexagon yet. Octagon. It was octagon shape. I went out and built a spearhead on it. I put about a 5-inch pipe on it. And then I keep about 20 foot of rope on that spear. And I could throw that out pretty regular and get my turtle. We had a lot of turtle.
Good eating, too, I thought.
Oh, boy.
Well, I was during the Depression.
Oh, yes. Oh, boy.
You said that was the way it kept meat on the table.
Yes, sir. We sure did. All right, the biggest one I ever got out there weighed 33 pounds after his head was cut off. Now, about all I ever kept was mossbacks, you know, the old snappers.
Yeah.
and because I didn't like the leatherback too well. I tried him a few times, but just a little bit fine and just a little bit sweet to suit me. They're a different flavor. But now we had a lot of turtle, a lot of fun.
Get some fish too? Did you get?
I didn't. We caught more fish because when we were on the boat, I take the night watch or usually the night crew. If they weren't pressured for the night watch, maybe. And while he was doing his work at night, washing the boilers or whatever, while he'd have maybe 7 or 8 lines out, you know. And why the bullheads we used to get out of there. You didn't catch many bluegills or anything like that right around there because of Riley, see. But boy, you sure catch bullheads.
You dug all the way up to the end of Craig Lake, did you? Went that far north?
Went clear up into the channel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they went into the channel after I left. I left in 43. And but we were in the channel after leaving Craig Lake. We dug all around in that area and cleaned it all pretty well out of Craig. And then we started up the channel. And but they dug a couple of years, I think, in there after I left. Because I left in 43, and I think they quit in, could have been 47. I'm not sure.
Just checking the map, it's about 5.5 miles from the Smith Factory to the north end of Craig Lake. About how long did that run take?
Oh, how long? Oh, with one scout, we go down an hour time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's flowing up. You got to have it slow down a little bit through the channel so you didn't cut too big a wake, you know. Coming back, well, you didn't have to slow down. Your scow would hold you back enough to... So you cut back to about 4 miles, 3.5, 4 miles an hour when you're loaded.
Did you work year-round, or did you get laid off in the winter?
On the start, the first couple of years, I got laid off most of the winter. And then after that, I stayed in, we'd work on rebuilding scows and carpenter shops and putting on new planking and whatever it took, you know, and an awful lot of machine work. You take these big, like I was telling a little bit ago, the separators that we call them, that are like sausage grinders. Take one little section, even at night. I made one man a pretty good handful just to handle that alone to pick it up. Because it had there was a big shaft somewhere in that area that just hung on the end of it and pressed against the head. But I worked all winter. And a lot of times we would out, I did on the start when I went back before they had been there too long. Maybe we'd worked a couple months out on these other lakes. We've been cold water lakes. We've been in Archer Lake. We even one winter went over to Brunson in that lake over there where the old cement plant used to be. They even talked then. I was back in the last of the 20s in that area, around the Depression time, of whether they would run a pipeline or trucks to haul it from, if they did hit a big marl spot out here, they were thinking then of cleaning this country out of marl. And then after they sold out, well, this other bunch of guys didn't care whether they, well, everything they told me that I heard was that they just, you take the ones at Landemeyer's and that bunch were big stockholders out here, you know, and Frank Murray's uncle, and Jones, wasn't it? Jones? He mixed up with Dan Jones, you know.
He is, huh?
Yeah. Now, he was an uncle, I believe, with Dan. And they had some money, and they had it in this cement plant, and it was a locally owned place.
Stock company, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. That's the way it started out. Well, then back in the, it must have been roughly, I think it was 2 or 3 years before I left, that was when they sold out, the controlling interest, they sold out to this other bunch, and the way they tell me, well, they just went in there to, they didn't care anything about what it did for the city or the country, or they just wanted to make a fast buck and get out.
That was a mistake to sell, wasn't it? For the community.
Sure was.
Do you think there's still Marl and Chandler?
Yeah, but I don't think there's enough to rebuild a new...
No.
I don't.
They didn't exploit all Marl.
No. Oh, no. There's, you take all heaven's place. You see the, what the world was it? It seems to me that 4% of sand would cause them a lot of trouble to be killed. And the deal of it was that sand would turn to glass and be just like grease and kill. And that would, the lining of the kill and the inside of the kill would just peel right off, seeing in that big black spot there. And it would affect the heat of it. And they would lose a lot of your insulation from that. So they tell me.
They couldn't get that sand out, apparently, if they didn't.
Not if we put it in when we dug it. That's the reason why we cut her pretty carefully. But if you had, you had to watch it. And anyone after they dug a while, they could tell when they got their marl, when they dug the marl up, and you let your bucket open, you could tell. You could educate your mind to it. Eye to it so that you could tell if there was sand in that, to any extent. And if it got 4.5%, you know it.
Well, are there areas that they didn't take all the marl? They didn't go deep enough to get all the
marl? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Now, there's a few places. There's one up, in Randall Lake. Where the public landing is there, fishing site. You go south of there, probably, oh gosh, I don't think, maybe 250, 300 feet. And there was a place there that it went below, I think we figured about 34 or 5 feet was all we could dig. But your spuds on each corner of the front end, you had spuds that were I think 46 feet long, and they stuck up here in the air when you was moving. See, then when you move ahead, if you got a spot dug out, you move ahead and you drop those spuds down, and you rock your boat, you jack yourself up on those solids, you see, you push them right down the bottom. Well, then you could go in there and you could dig. But you wouldn't dare to go over, as I say, 34 or 5 feet. If you wanted to dig any more of it, you'd have to turn around and back over it, because you wouldn't have anything to put your spuds on you. See?
Well, this maybe answers the question we had when these maps, lakes are mapped, that we noticed on the lake down here, Messenger Lake, that it was apparently dug to about, I think about 11, 12 feet, and no deeper. It wasn't deep. Because you couldn't get deeper, it was because the marl ran out there. Was that what you're saying?
That's most cases, yeah. You were down to the sand.
Yeah, so they stopped, so just the limit of the marl laying in there. And
but, you see, the thing of it is there, you know, when you talk like that, you run into another problem. When you go in here to dig, you've got surface. You might have 8 foot of surface that was marked.
Well, the marl was overlaid.
That wasn't any good.
What do you do with that?
You have to throw that off here where you've done before. You throw that all off, then you could go on down and get, but that 7 or 8 feet, whatever you took off, you're going to fill up over here.
Comes back.
Yeah.
It?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I saw that.
Yeah.
I suppose the marl that they used was... regular service.
No, I take up there in Randall Lake. You don't go down the river road. And that's just this side of where old George Randall used to live. There's a hole in there. Remember that?
We left an island there one place.
Yeah, but then we left this hole, and then they dug a channel and went back down there and built those houses on it years later. But there's a big hole here.
Deep hole.
Yeah. Well, they was after it for years, the different diggers, to dig that out. We had to start clear out here in the lake to come into it, but they knew that pocket was in there because they'd been in and sampled it. So I was probably out there 10 years, and then somebody, I know who does. You remember Jeff Russell, he used to live around,
yeah,
down Ernie Russell's dad. My dad used to work for Jeff Russell on the dredge, on his miner's dredge, because him and his brother-in-law, Ernie Miner, was together. So in their talk, Jeff Russell was telling Louis Nodell. Louis was telling that he was going to get a hold of a digger, somebody that run a dredge. He said, "You got one working for you." No, he said, "We haven't." He said, "Only the ones that we got on the job." Well, he said, "You can go on out there." And he told him about me, that I'd run dredges before I went there. See, I never told it because they didn't pay that kind of wages. I just worked the wheel and tug, and because what they give the digger wasn't only peanuts compared to extra, you know, and all the responsibility too. But just soon they found out, well, it wasn't long before they had me on the fence too. So I wheel tug 10 years, and the last 6 years I dug. And that's when they started to call me to get into that little hole up there along the, right in the bend of the road there where all those cottages are. And, but just to give you an idea, I surfaced 19 feet of surface to get in there, dig a hole big enough to get in there to get that marl up. 19 feet. Now we had marl. We had muck and stuff around our ears, I'll tell you.
It wasn't tough.
It was rough.
Well, were the lakes pretty riley when you were doing that?
Just in the area.
Just that area.
Now, if you've got wind, and if you're anywhere near the channel of the current, well, it'll clear through. But mostly the worst part of it is just right in your area, you know.
Were you bothered any by spring floods or anything like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. A lot of times we'd have to sink or put water or ballast of some kind, usually water. We let as much water in as we dared to lower tugs get in on the bridge. Almost every spring we'd have to take our headlights off. We had headlights up on the top, you know, that just old automobile lights is what they were. But we'd have to take them off in order to clear the, because we'd come too close to the bridge.
All the time you were there, did they run the little engine down to the clay pit?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get in down there?
Yes, I did. Yeah, when I first started in, Chubb Davis was a foreman over there. And, well, Chubb would be Davis out to the marina for our lake.
Oh.
That would be his grandfather, or an uncle. His grandfather, I believe, Chuck. And,
They have, saw a picture one time of a, looks like about a Model T would look. It wasn't a Model T type of a shovel. Did you ever see that? It was apparently dug the clay out of the banks out there. Was that there when you were there? An old, looks like an old type of steam shovel of some type. I don't know whether it was steam or whether it just looked that way. What's this in the picture? How did they dig it? You know, how did they...
Most of the time they had the cranes.
They had a little narrow gauge railroad, is that?
Yes. Then they the Quincy didn't have a coal, a clay plant, clay pit, and they hauled it from here.
What about Brunson?
On a freight.
Was Brunson all freight from here too?
No, I don't know about Brunson. That was before, that was gone before I got in here. I don't know about Brunson. I couldn't tell you, but I'll bet they had clay right in there close to in that area.
Don't know where it would be.
Georgia.
So on the, is there poor quality clay and good quality clay back here, or could they just take anything that came up?
Oh, it had, I think it had to have a consistency for brick or something of that sort. I think that'd be pretty good.
They had to grind that clay.
It had to be pulverized, yeah.
Was that done at the factory or back at the...
No, it was pulverized up here at the factory. And it's, where you go into the plant now, it's just to the east of where the office was. There was a place there that they pulled the marl in and put it through the grinder there.
Go ahead.
You go out in the winter, probably because you didn't have enough work. You go out and get the samples. I never knew quite. Now I know what he was doing.
Yeah.
He was working on that.
No. Because in the wintertime, he wouldn't have anything to, his chemical work would be just about shot, see? But by doing this, then they knew how much marl they had out there, and Mike was pretty good on drawing maps, and Mike was more or less the leader, because he was the one that was running the laboratory. And but you'd run a chain, and he'd draw the maps, and they had the regular map paper, and we'd take a line off of something that was pretty permanent, you know, and line fence or something of that sort, and chain linker from there. And you had your compass.
Going back to factory for a minute, do you have any idea how much clay and marl it took for a batch? How was the proportion of clay?
Oh, gosh.
Did it take as much clay as it did marl?
No, not near as much clay. No. It was quite a lot of difference.
Well, then rock was part of the roll around in the mixture, was part of the process.
What was that?
Rock. Didn't they put rock in the processing just to roll around in the machine?
Well, they had a fineness to grind it. What they really had is steel balls.
Ball driver, huh?
They didn't use rock.
Not when I was there. No, they probably did when they started.
Well, the history of the Union City plant, they used rock, and I'm just wondering whether they got rock hard enough. But.
No,
after the granite, wasn't it?
But they, out here, they had steel balls that they used in the slurry end of it, and they run through the big tubular thing, you see, and they run that stuff right down through it, and that'd give you the fineness that you wanted there. Then they would mix the clay and the coal, fine dust, coal dust, and the marl, mix that all together. Then you'd go up in the kiln, and then have a big fire in the kiln, you see. Well, that fire, that stuff came down through, it'd probably come third of the way or so, and then it started drying as it came down through. When it got down roughly, now that is halfway, well, then from there on down it would be a fire, see, and it would burn to a clinker.
Then they ground that up for cement.
And they pulverized it, and they had these big hammer mills. They were big steel balls. seemed to me they weighed, when they first put them in there, this book weighed 100 pounds. And they worked in a thing like this, see? And then there's a rim around the edge of the, of that, and that going round and round in there with a big bell on it and spinning there, you see?
Sounds like a mortar and
stuff? Yeah, it, that's right. It's
mechanical
from that
mortar.
It's from that area.
It must have taken a lot of toll over the thing.
Oh, you bet. Sure did. It sure did. Lots of it. The when they run the Quincy plant, I was wheeling tubs over here. No, I was digging. And they, when they, one year, they would run the Quincy plant. The old guys would go from both plants and run one plant. And then the next year, you'd take all the old guys from both plants and run the other one. See, you change back and forth like that.
Same management, I take it.
Hmm?
They were both under the same management.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
But not drunk. Then.
Well, they...
originally, were they?
Oh, yes.
All out of town?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You bet. And, but then, when I go to the first year or two, that we went to Quincy, I was on the tub after we got over there. Well, then they had trouble up on the clay pile, or on the coal pile. So they wanted me to go up there, and I run that crane over there in the, and handle the coal that was coming in. And they were using, as I remember back now, they run 4 or 5 cars of coal a day.
Mm.
You bet.
A lot of coal.
Oh, boy.
So the cement they made, was it all bagged, or how did it leave the plant?
Oh, there was some of it. There was some bulk. Some of it was sent bulk.
In box cars?
In box cars. Uh-huh. And I didn't work in the packing room very much. But I knew the guys pretty well that did work up there. And I had helped up there from one time to another, maybe in the winter. They needed an extra hand. Why, you might go up for a day or two, or they might send somebody down to help you for a day or two, you know, whatever you had to do. But but that, a lot of that went off just in the ball.
Did Roy Baum ever haul anything?
Oh, sure. You bet. You
yeah,
all.
Tank.
No. But that was before Tank, as I knew of.
He hauled it in the bulk.
Yeah.
Or in the
no,
bag.
No, not that I know of.
In bag.
Yeah, in bag, yeah. That I knew about.
And he got into tank trucks.
He might have. Yeah. Good. After I left, probably.
So was any of the cement work around here that you recall made from cement?
Oh, sure. Sure. I'm positive that Grand Street is one of them.
The pavement, Grand Street pavement.
Huh?
God, it was brick,
right? Yeah, well, that was brick. But I'm just positive because
what about Chicago outside of town? Is that?
I couldn't tell you.
You
no, for sure. No. No. Couldn't tell.
One thing I think I may ought to try and get would be a picture of one of those old barges. There might be one around someplace in Canada. We could get a picture of it. Do you remember where you've seen one? You know,
the only thing, they're all sunk, as I know of.
You can see portions of them over here. I've been down to that too.
Well, you see, on the channel, oh.
South of Quincy, there's one that yeah. Shows up to the right on
there. I can picture one like that. You go along with the ship and have it. Real good there. Did you have anything then, like they have now, like union or unemployment compensation, or did you have retirement or any of those things?
Back when I Before Social Security, nothing.
Another thing.
What was the least they ever paid you?
40 cents an hour. When I quit, I'd been working for Pratt, and I had in fact, the guy lived here. He was renting my place that I'd bought this and before I was married. And the fellow that was living here came to me and he said, how would you like a different job? And I said, I'd like one if I could get more money. Well, he said, I don't know if you can get any more money, but he said, you can make more hours. I said the same thing to me. So I went out there, and every doggone thing didn't hire me. 40 cents an hour. But you didn't get overtime. You got 40 cents. If you worked 1 hour or you worked 24. And that was one of the little things that I had to find out before I... And Louis was a guy that quite evasive. Louis Nodell, he quite evasive. He wouldn't give you a decent answer. And I said, if you do have, I said, you're not gonna. You know, he kept sawing that old dog around. So finally then, he said, no, he said, it'll be the same. I said, that's all I want to know. So, boy, oh boy.
That's more than you got at Pratt, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, because at Pratt's only got 8 hours a day, too.
What was the peak number of employees in the factory?
The whole
crew.
Yeah. The whole crew run, I don't know, I've got a figure in my mind that I'm sure of 112 to 15, 18. And that's, most of that's on 12-hour shift, too. That's pretty in the 12-hour shift. Because there was an awful lot of it that was 12 hours then.
Is that a 6 day week?
Seven.
Seven.
You got 7 days.
Well, I get an interesting.
That sure
does. I guess it's pretty long.